Previously on Red Pilled America.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious.
Several thousand students have gathered for what has been billed as a victory celebration.
Do you see this as an issue that will be affecting other campuses, or is this a specific problem in your own school?
No, I think that this will, in the near future, begin affecting other campuses.
They were Marxists that were intellectually fueled by the ideas of the Frankfurt School.
We want black power.
Silence is. It will always be necessary.
The ground can and must be prepared.
Herbert Marcuse taught me that it was possible to be a scholar and a revolutionary.
Where did wokeness come from? I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth.
Welcome to Red Pilled America.
We're at the third part of our series of episodes entitled Woke Army. You've probably heard part one and two, but if you haven't, stop and go back and listen from the beginning. We're looking for the answer to the question, where did wokeness come from? By telling the story of how an obscure group of German refugees started all of this woke madness and what we need to do to stop it.
So in part one, we told the story of how German Marxist intellectuals started the Frankfurt School in 1923, then fled to the United States 10 years later to develop a new brand of Marxism that could potentially ignite a socialist revolution in the West. By the late 1950s, these radicals coalesced around a consensus that capitalism was making the working class too comfortable, draining the revolutionary energy out of their proletariat. As a result, they'd need a new oppressed group to spark a socialist revolution.
In part two, we learned how a dark alliance began forming in the early 1960s that was fueled by the ideas of the Frankfurt School. This alliance first revealed itself in a 1964 protest at UC Berkeley. A radical group wanted to end the university's policy prohibiting political activity on campus. So they challenged the rule by setting up political informational tables on the university premises. The school took the bait, and campus police arrested one of the table attendants. But as they tried to haul him off, students surrounded the squad car and refused to let it leave. One of the protest instigators, Mario Savio, demanded their comrade be released and the school terminate all campus political speech restrictions. A 32-hour standoff ensued until the university agreed to review the rule. But after a few weeks, school officials reemerged with their verdict, deciding to suspend the protest leader, Mario Savio, and eight other students. That's when the protesters went ballistic, occupying the school administration building. They shut down the entire school. Hundreds were arrested, and after 2 months of constant protest, the university completely capitulated, dropping all charges against the protesters and terminating all restrictions on political activity. The protest was branded as the Free Speech Movement, but it was a charade. A participant would later admit that it was really about clearing barriers to using the campus as a base for radical political activity. It was orchestrated by a group of Marxists that had been trained by both the Communist Party USA and a radical black student protest organization called SNCC, led by Stokely Carmichael.
A relative unknown in 1964, Stokely was a Howard University grad that grew impatient with Martin Luther King Jr.'s nonviolent approach to protest. He was instead becoming inspired by the aggressive posture of black nationalist Malcolm X. So when Malcolm X was killed in 1965, Stokely Carmichael picked up where he left off and would quickly become the ringleader of the new Black Power movement. He'd eventually be christened the honorary Prime Minister of the Black Panthers, a militant Black Power political organization born in Oakland. In 1967, Stokely connected with Herbert Marcuse at a conference in London to address rising violence in the world. In America, riots had erupted all across the country in urban cities like Detroit. Stokely and Marcuse were invited to the London conference to represent the new left's rationale for violent revolution in the United States. Marcuse was the guest of honor at the gathering, heralded as a genius for his writings, including a new concept he developed called repressive tolerance, where he argued that for the new left to start a socialist revolution, it needed to censor all movements coming from the right and tolerate any movement coming from the left, even if they were violent. In the crowd at the conference was a student of Marcuse's that wanted to follow in his footsteps. Her name was Angela Davis, a young Alabama-born black radical who'd grown up around communists. Angela studied philosophy under Marcuse at Brandeis College. After graduating in 1965, she went to Germany to study under Marcuse's Frankfurt School colleagues, Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno. When the Black Panthers exploded onto the scene in 1967, she wanted to join their movement. So after a brief stop at the London conference to meet the Black Panther Stokely Carmichael and her teacher, she headed back to America, where she was set to study under Herbert Marcuse at the University of California at San Diego.
When Angela Davis arrived in California in 1967, the stage was set for Herbert Marcuse's new proletariat to erupt into action. The Black Power movement was attracting new members like flies to a heaping pile of shit. The sexual revolution was underway, the feminist movement was growing, socialist radicals had made inroads into universities like UC Berkeley, and now even colleges had open Marxist professors like Herbert Marcuse. If each of these factions could come together, they could produce a woke army with the kind of energy necessary to start a socialist revolution in America.
As the 1967-1968 school year began, Angela Davis wanted to connect with the growing Black Panthers in California. It was a strange desire for an academic of all people to want to be connected with the Black Power organization. After just a year of existence, they'd already shown an insatiable penchant for violence. In October 1967, one of the Panthers' founders, Huey Newton, was accused of murdering a police officer. After his arrest, a representative of the Panthers issued a warning to the American people.
The Black Panther Party demands that Huey P. Newton be set free. And we wish to make it very clear that if he is not set free, there is little hope of avoiding open armed war in the streets of California and sweeping across this nation.
The Black Panthers were becoming more and more militant, threatening all-out warfare. It was the kind of revolutionary organization that almost no respectable intellectual prior to the 1960s would have wanted to be associated with. Yet, Angela Davis, an academic, was looking to join the group. Why? Well, simply put, she wanted to bring Frankfurt School Marxism into the Black Power movement. Within a matter of weeks after landing in California, Angela was working with the Los Angeles chapter of the Black Panther organization, setting up a rally in Los Angeles to demand the release of the Black Panther founder, Huey Newton. The campaign became known as the Free Huey Campaign. She helped secure the Los Angeles sports arena for the leaders of the Black Panthers. It was the largest indoor venue in Los Angeles at the time, and on the day of the rally, the main floor of the arena was packed.
This is our country. It was built on our back by our labor. We built the country up. We'll burn it down if it don't hurry up and come around.
Attendees of the February 1968 gathering would receive a heaping dose of vitriolic speeches from Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown, each calling for a revolution by any means necessary, including violence.
Now, there's a new alliance that Brother James Forman talked about. It's my pleasure to introduce to you the Minister of Justice for the Black Panther Party of Self-Defense, Chairman of SNCC, Brother Rapp Brown.
J.P. Newton is now confined in jail because of our lack of action. We accuse ourselves of being revolutionaries. How many white cops have died since Huey P. Newton has been in jail? None. None. He killed the last honky that died from a bullet from a black gun. The only thing that Huey Newton is guilty of, perhaps, is that he didn't tell me he was going down on the honkies that day. That's the only thing.
H. Rapp Brown began to see the new revolutionary alliance that Herbert Marcuse identified in his book, One Dimensional Man.
The revolution that this country is facing will be a revolution of dispossessed people. That means Mexican Americans, Puerto Ricans, blacks, American Indians, and every dispossessed class in this country. These are our allies. Black people, if they're going to be free, must begin to seize power. Chairman Mao says power comes from the barrel of a gun. You better get you a gun, brother. I don't care if it ain't nothing but a BB gun with poison BBs. America has shown us that she does not respect anything but counterforce. You must begin to broaden your concept. You got to get beyond the racist pig cop. You see, because he is a tool of the man who really controls the system. We're not only talking about destroying a power structure. We're talking about ruination of a system. Black people cannot afford to become capitalists.
But what was perhaps most interesting was the Black Panther's position on the American institution of education.
Black people must begin to understand everything that you don't control becomes a weapon against you. The education system today is a weapon against black people. It expounds and teaches white nationalism.
I really don't need to call his name. Brother Stokely Carmichael, Black Power. Now, Brother Rapp ran it down very nicely. I'll just add to it. Education don't help us in this country. It cripples us. That is a fact. Our communities are filled with hustlers, pimps, dope addicts, prostitutes, number men, racketeers, preachers, teachers, maids, porters, and some factory workers. Not one black school in the country has a curriculum geared to teach us how to be a good pimp, good hustler, good preacher, good teacher, good anything. Not one. Not one. If the education is to teach us how to live in our community, then it must do one of two things. Prepare us to live in that community by teaching us how to be good prostitutes, good maids, good preachers, or by teaching us how to change our community so we can live like human beings. So we can live like human beings. Our school system does neither. And when our young people, who are very intelligent, drop out of school because they recognize the game, the honky is running on them, they have us fighting them, saying, get back in school. Get back to what? White nationalism? If we want our children to go to school, we have to educate them. We have to educate them. We have to educate them. Nobody else. There is no race in history that give their young to another race to educate. No race at all. No race at all. We are the only race that allow our enemy to educate our youth against us. We must educate our people. In order to educate our people, it means that we must take over the schools, nothing less. Take them over by any means necessary.
This message resonated with Angela Davis. It was early 1968, and she was studying for her master's under Herbert Marcuse. It may have looked nearly impossible at the time, but a takeover of education, one of the most important institutions that defines what it means to be American, was the kind of win that could slowly spread Marxism throughout the country. It was an ambitious goal, but what they needed was a new trigger to unleash the pent-up energy that was building within this new growing alliance. That trigger would come on April 4th, 1968.
Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene.
Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So in early 1968, Herbert Marcuse's disciple Angela Davis organized a rally to demand the release of Black Panther's founder, Huey Newton, who was arrested for murdering a cop. At the rally, leaders of the Black Panthers argued that their new alliance must take over the schools by any means necessary. A takeover of education, one of the most important institutions, was the kind of win that could slowly spread Marxism throughout the country. It was an ambitious goal, but what they needed was a new trigger to unleash the pent-up energy that was building within the new growing alliance. That trigger would come on April 4th, 1968.
Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Governor Buford Ellington has called out 4,000 National Guardsmen. And police report that the murder has touched off sporadic acts of violence in a Negro section of the city. In a nationwide television address, President Johnson expressed the nation's shock.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King. I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence.
In the hours that followed, violence erupted again in America.
Washington, Chicago, Detroit, Boston, New York, these are just a few of the cities in which the Negro anguish over Dr. King's murder, presumably by a white man, expressed itself in violent destruction.
The tragic event was just the kind of news that Herbert Marcuse's new formed alliance needed to incite a revolution. The Black Panther's Stokely Carmichael stepped to the microphone and warned of the coming violence.
When white America killed Dr. King last night, she opened the eyes for every black man in this country. When white America got rid of Marcus Garvey, she did it and she said he was an extremist. He was crazy. When they got rid of Brother Malcolm X, they said he was preaching hate. He deserved what he got. But when they got rid of Brother Martin Luther King, they had absolutely no reason to do so. He was the one man in our race who was trying to teach our people to have love, compassion, and mercy for what white people had done. When white America killed Dr. King last night, she declared war on us. There will be no crying, there will be no funerals. The rebellions that have been occurring around the cities of this country is just light stuff to what is about to happen. We have to retaliate for the death of our leaders. The execution of those deaths will not be in the courtrooms. They're going to be in the streets of the United States of America. When white America killed Dr. King last night, she made a whole lot easier for a whole lot of black people today. There no longer needs to be intellectual discussions. Black people know that they have to get guns. White America will live to cry that she killed Dr. King last night.
Stokely Carmichael was right. For the next week, riots, looting, and arson swept through Washington, D.C., Chicago, Baltimore, Detroit, New York City, Pittsburgh, Kansas City, Cincinnati, Trenton, Louisville, and Wilmington, Delaware. The Black Panthers tried to murder and ambush police officers in Oakland. Their first member, Bobby Hutton, was killed in the process. The unrest came to be known as the Holy Week Uprising. Some historians called it the worst wave of American social unrest since the Civil War, and the Marxist agitators took advantage of the situation to further their socialist revolution.
We now demand we no longer ask a say in decisions that affect our lives.
On April 23, 1968, just a few weeks after MLK Jr.'s killing, two groups of radical students began an unprecedented protest at Columbia University in New York City, the same American campus that first housed the Frankfurt School. They took over Hamilton Hall, which housed the university's administration offices, and school officials tried to get them to disperse. One of the occupying groups was called the Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS, a Marxist organization that looked to replace America's capitalist system with communism.
We call on all students, faculty, staff, and workers of the university to support our strike. We ask that all students and faculty not meet or have classes inside buildings. We have taken the power away from an irresponsible and illegitimate administration. We have taken power away from a board of self-perpetuating businessmen who call themselves trustees of this university. We're demanding an end to the construction of the gymnasium being built against the will of the people of the community of Harlem. We are no longer asking, but demanding an end to all affiliation and ties with the Institute for Defense Analysis.
The other group of radicals that took over the school was the Society of Afro-American Students, or SAS, a group connected to the Black Power movement. The Black Panthers, Stokely Carmichael, and H. Rapp Brown joined the group at Columbia to make their demands.
The black students of Columbia University, joined by a few members of the black community, have been in Hamilton Hall for 56 hours. Now, the brothers in here maintain that they will stay here until the university is willing to talk on their terms. And we are going in the community of Harlem and bolster the support down there. So we're going to let Columbia know that if they don't want to deal with the brothers in here, they're going to deal with the brothers on the street.
The students set up barricades to keep the police out. Then they unbelievably took the university's dean hostage for 24 hours. And in just the first 2 days, they took over 5 school buildings. The radical protesters completely shut down campus operations. The occupation lasted over a week. The agitators claimed that their protest was over the university's involvement in weapons development and the unwanted construction of a gymnasium in Harlem. But just like UC Berkeley, it was all a charade. They had a different goal in mind. The leader of one of the agitator groups, Mark Rudd of SDS, later admitted that they'd manufactured the issues. And why?
Is SDS, Mark, really interested in Columbia, or is it just a stepping stone? Are you concerned with something much bigger than Columbia? Why did you use Columbia, or did you use Columbia?
I say that neither is true, or both are true. So what it is a training ground.
As former Congressman Dr. Walter H. Judd said in the aftermath, the takeover of Columbia University was a training exercise with the ultimate goal being a violent socialist takeover of the United States. And it wasn't just America that was putting the Frankfurt School's ideas into practice. Herbert Marcuse was becoming an icon in Europe as well.
Beginning on May 2, 1968, just hours after the Columbia University violence ended, France experienced one of its largest civil unrest in modern times. It was sparked by a group of Marxist students protesting against capitalism and American imperialism.
La structure autoritaire de l'université est contre la bourgeoisie. Vive le socialisme!
The protests grew when trade unions called sympathy strikes to align with the radical students. An estimated 11 million workers joined in the protest, over 20% of the population of France at the time. The French economy grinded to a halt. The situation got so dire that the national government briefly ceased functioning. Fearing an all-out civil war, the country's president secretly fled to Germany. The surprising twist was the person that the French media was blaming for the unrest. According to the country's newspapers, the demonstrations were started because of Herbert Marcuse's book, One Dimensional Man.
His writings about the frustrations of modern man in contemporary Western society have been especially popular in Europe.
Angela Davis later reminisced about the massive French protest.
Herbert Marcuse was committed to an immediate political activism in speaking at rallies. Of course, in 1968, in France, with the great student uprisings, there are Marcuse's name was invoked, and he spoke.
The rallying call for the French protesters was Mao Marx Marcuse. A former student of Marcuse's was in Paris at the time and witnessed firsthand the situation his professor found himself in.
Students were demonstrating outside at the university. Tear gas was flying. Marcuse arrived at the conference hall and was suddenly surrounded by reporters. And of course, what this was all about was a newspaper stories that had been published in the preceding weeks saying that Marcuse was the thinker who had inspired the student revolt that was going on outside.
The French protest went on for 7 weeks, but the violence was just getting started. A few months later, violent student protests erupted at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
The whole world is watching! The whole world is watching!
Word began to spread in America that Herbert Marcuse's writings were igniting these student uprisings.
Recently, wherever they had a riot in Europe, they had the riots in Rome, and Marcuse showed up.
They had the riots in Paris when the French had to bring out the troops and the tanks. Marcuse was there. When they had the riots with the students in Berlin, Marcuse was there. It seems to be that wherever the radicals in this new left, so-called new left, appear, Marcuse somewhere is in the background. We are convinced that he has to convey some of his ideas and thoughts directly to the students, and this lies the danger of Marcuse to the University of California.
Marcuse's popularity with students began sparking the interest of the media, who wanted to know if he actually endorsed the violence.
I gather you are a bit ambivalent about the use of violence.
What do you mean by ambivalent?
That you have mixed feelings. You sometimes think it is good and other times think it's bad.
I think that anyone who loves violence for the sake of violence is a fatally sick human being.
Well, there was certainly violence against people in the Paris riots.
Counter-violence, that I have seen. The students were perfectly peaceful. And the police got orders first to clear the court of the Sorbonne and then to clear the streets. And you know that they don't do that exactly in the way of a nursemaid singing the baby to sleep.
Counter-violence is okay, in your view.
It's not a question whether or not it's okay. It is a question when and where it is necessary. Necessary in order to keep alive yourself and what you stand for.
In the summer of 1968, San Diego's American Legion, a powerful political group at the time, began putting pressure on UCSD's new chancellor, Willie McGill, to fire the Marxist professor.
Earlier this week, a group of 1,000 outraged citizens took out an ad in a local newspaper demanding that McGill's inauguration be called off. They also demanded that philosophy professor Herbert Marcuse be fired.
The new chancellor responded.
The Legion proposes to offer $20,000 to buy up Professor Marcuse's contract. You don't buy up a professor's contract. You can't even do this with a professional football player, and a university is a far more responsible place in our society.
By the end of 1968, pressure was building to fire Marcuse, and it was being amped up by no other than the new governor of California, Ronald Reagan.
At the time, Ronald Reagan had already had a long history of fighting communist infiltration in American institutions. In 1944, he joined Hollywood heavy hitters John Wayne, Walt Disney, Clark Gable, Ginger Rogers, Cecil B. DeMille, and many others to form the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals, a Hollywood industry group created to defend the film industry from communist and fascist infiltration. In 1946, as a member of the Screen Actors Guild Board, Reagan was asked to mediate a labor dispute with the union leader Herbert Sorrell. Sorrell was a communist that benefited from violent confrontation at the Hollywood studios. Reagan personally witnessed Sorrell incite union members to commit violence at the studio's gates. They overturned buses, smashed windows, and left people bloodied. So Reagan took on Sorrell by crossing the picket lines. Sorrell then labeled Reagan a fascist and called on union members to boycott his movies. Some agitators went as far as sending Reagan anonymous threats that his face would be mutilated to ruin his acting career. The actor had an awakening moment. He decided he wouldn't let the communists gain control of the storytelling industry that helped define the American ideal. He began carrying a gun. When he became the president of the Screen Actors Guild, Reagan was determined to flush communists out of the industry. In 1947, he testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee as a friendly witness.
I will be frank with you that as a citizen, I would hesitate or I would not like to see any political party outlawed on the basis of its political ideology, because we've spent 170 years in this country on the basis that democracy is strong enough to stand up and fight for itself against the inroads of any ideology, no matter how much we may disagree with it. However, if it is proven that this organization is the agent of a foreign power or is in any way not a legitimate political party, and I think the government is capable of doing that, if the proof is there, then that is another matter. We have done a pretty good job in our business of keeping those people's activities curtailed. After all, we must legally recognize them at the present as a political party. On that basis, we have exposed their lies when we came across them. We have been eminently successful in preventing them from their usual tactic of trying to run a majority of an organization with a well-organized minority.
So when Reagan saw radicals like Herbert Marcuse creating chaos at universities in his home state, Reagan ran for governor of California on a platform of law and order. And he minced no words about what should be done when students put their radical professors' ideas into action.
There, a small minority of beatniks, radicals, and filthy speech advocates have brought shame on a great university. Applications for enrollment have dropped 21%, and there's evidence they'll continue to drop even more. Now, we've all read the press reportings of the report that was handed in by the Senate subcommittee. In its charges, that the campus has become a rallying point for communists and a center for sexual misconduct. And it began a year ago when the so-called free speech advocates, who in truth have no appreciation for freedom, were allowed to assault and humiliate the symbol of law and order, a policeman on the campus. And that was the moment when the ringleaders should have been taken by the scruff of the neck and thrown out of the university once and for all.
Reagan became governor in 1967, and when it became clear that Herbert Marcuse and the Black Panthers had been the primary instigators inciting students towards violence, he began to apply pressure on the University of California regents to fire Marcuse and prohibit the Black Panthers from speaking on California college campuses. In November 1968, Reagan traveled to San Diego to attend a UC Regents meeting on the topic. When he arrived, Herbert Marcuse joined students to stage a protest of Reagan's visit. And this time they tried a different tactic in front of the media. They chose a silent protest.
Governor, what do you think of this well-disciplined, quiet demonstration compared to some of the disturbances you've encountered in the past? This is purposely done this way.
Well, and I'm very appreciative of it. I think it's a little more adult than some of the things we've seen in the past.
They hope that this will have an effect on the region in their decisions today.
Well, it would be fine if they really understood what was going on, but they don't.
You don't think they understand what's going on?
No.
The UC Regents decided to shift the decision of whether to fire Marcuse over to the university that was employing him. And in February 1969, UCSD's chancellor announced a creative workaround.
The University of California, San Diego, today announced its intention to reappoint Dr. Herbert Marcuse as professor of philosophy for the academic year 1969-70.
But
accordingly, we have decided to terminate all existing commitments to overage professors as of June 1970 and to replace these with a policy of expected retirement at a specified age.
UCSD didn't want the appearance that the governor or community outrage was forcing their hand. So it decided to change its policy to force his retirement.
Dr. McGill, would you say that this new policy you've just inaugurated was a direct result of your problem concerning Dr. Marcuse?
No, it was not.
Marcuse called into a local radio station to issue a statement about the decision.
It is not my reappointment that is at stake. I have quite a few offers to teach, in spite of my biological age. What is at stake is the right and the duty of the scholar and educator to teach the truth and to expose the lies. It serves or ought to serve whole generations of human beings, regardless of race, color, religion, and business requirements.
Marcuse would be forced to retire in a year. With his fate now sealed at UCSD, the gloves could come off. He'd just issued Angela Davis her master's in philosophy and began working with her towards her doctorate. And this was important, because the Frankfurt School Marxists wanted the young Black Power intellectual to take their baton and run with it within the hallowed halls of American academia.
Welcome back to Red-Pilled America. So Ronald Reagan successfully pressured UCSD to come up with a creative way to retire Herbert Marcuse in the coming year. With his fate now sealed at UCSD, the gloves could come off. Marcuse had just issued Angela Davis her master's in philosophy and began working with her towards her doctorate. And this was important, because the Frankfurt School Marxists wanted the young black power intellectual to take their baton and run with it within the hallowed halls of American academia. As the end of the 1969 school year approached, Marcuse began arguing in the pages of the New York Times that the violent student protests could be considered nonviolent when compared to the capitalist society that oppressed them. Just days later, Angela Davis put his writings into action. She organized an occupation of a UCSD building.
We were demanding a college. We wanted a college. They were about to construct the third college. We said the name of this college is going to be Lumumba Zapata College. Oh, yes. And we developed a curriculum.
We developed the idea of creating a college that would reflect the needs of the academic as well as community needs of people of African descent, Latinos, and working class white peoples.
We wanted to demonstrate the extent to which we were serious. We decided to occupy the registrar's office. So I went to Marcuse and told him about our plan, and I asked him whether he would come with us. No question about it, of course. And as a matter of fact, when we took over the building, we had to kick in the door, break the glass, and the first person to occupy the building, the first person to set foot into the building was Herbert Marcuse.
The following day, the occupiers took to the school campus.
In the wake of yesterday evening's takeover of the registrar's office, the Black Student Council and the Mexican American Youth Association held a rally in the free speech area of the campus at noon today. They issued the following statement. The taking of the registrar's office was the only course of action because the Academic Senate had not met the demands of the supporters of the Lumumba Zapata College.
In parallel, violent student protests bubbled up in other parts of the country as well. City College of New York had to close down because of outbreaks of fights. Black radicals seized six Howard University buildings and barricaded two traffic gates leading into campus. State troopers had to clear out protesters who'd taken over Dartmouth College's administration building. Indiana College students marched on the Indianapolis State House. Purdue University students began a one-day boycott, embarking on a sit-in in one of their campus buildings. An unrest erupted at Uppsala College and St. Peter's College in New Jersey. But nothing to date compared to the violence that broke out on May 15, 1969, at the birthplace of radical student insurrection. By early May 1969, students and area socialists commandeered a plot of land owned by UC Berkeley that was set to be made into an athletic field. The agitators quickly converted the land into what they called the People's Park. Governor Reagan, who'd run on a platform of law and order, wasn't having it. He believed that it was going to be used for radical political activity. The socialist instigators that created the park warned the school that if they moved ahead with the construction plan on the plot of land, then they'd physically destroy the university. So, in the early hours of May 15, 1969, Governor Reagan sent law enforcement to the plot of land to clear it out.
This property is private. You are now trespassing, and unless you leave, you will be arrested for trespassing.
Law enforcement erected a fence around it. Governor Reagan anticipated a confrontation. He was right. Mario Savio, one of the primary Marxist instigators of the so-called free speech protests at UC Berkeley, began rallying people on campus to retake the so-called People's Park.
So what do we do with all of our free time? As I see it, the great hope implicit in the People's Park is that in our leisure time, so to speak, we will make the social revolution.
Other socialist instigators joined him to incite the crowd.
I have a suggestion. Let's go down to the People's Park.
An estimated 3,000 rally attendees began marching from UC Berkeley towards the fenced-off property chanting, "We want the park." The crowd was hostile. They attempted to overturn and burn police vehicles. They threw rocks and bottles at law enforcement. Some were on top of buildings, hurling objects at them. Under attack, police fired tear gas, birdshot, and then buckshot at the attackers. over 125 rioters were hospitalized. One was killed in the melee. That night, Reagan called a state of emergency and moved over 2,500 National Guardsmen into the area. In the days that followed, UC Berkeley protesters took to the streets to rally students to continue to occupy the park.
Conditions of unlawful assembly exist under authority of Section 726 of the California Penal Code, and in the name of the people of the state of California,
Angela Davis and other UCSD student activists called for an end to Ronald Reagan's efforts to end the conflict. Reagan wouldn't give in. He pushed law enforcement to continue to clear the streets.
I'm Chief Beal of the Berkeley Police Department. At 9:05, we declared this to be an unlawful assembly. There is no permit for this meeting. No one ever attempted to obtain one. This is an illegal meeting. Now, you have time to move out of here slowly and in a dignified manner, and there won't be any necessity for a confrontation. But we are going to clean the street.
As the conflict continued over the next 2 weeks, Ronald Reagan held a press conference where radical faculty members began to chastise the governor for his actions.
Who are you?
Will you let me finish my
I would like to hear who you are.
Happy now.
You bet I'm happy, and you bet you won't say anything that'll surprise me.
And I'd love to see you discuss this openly before the people of California.
I am discussing it openly.
And we'll know that you can't run a university by bayonet. You cannot do it that way. If you would allow yourself to listen, you would have a lot of people who would be showing some compassion, some interest in nonviolence, some interest in order. If you would speak out against the use of firearms and buckshot, and say, if you will, that the people responsible for that should be removed. If you would say
Mr.
that
Wofsy,
instead of an example of cutting down the escalation, you can bet we'd have a lot.
Mr. Wofsy, when were any of you? When did any of you appear before the students? When did any of you stand up at Sproul Hall on Thursday
over
and beg them not to go down
again,
there?
Over 100 people have been shot down. 100 people that I'm sure the record will show. Gas, lethal gas. That has been classified, as far as I know, is being used.
Once the dogs of war are unleashed, you must expect that things will happen and people being human will make mistakes on both sides. But this violence...
We're here because people are being shot and killed.
Some of the radical faculty members argued that Reagan should have negotiated with the rioters.
Those people told you for days in advance that if the university sought to go ahead with that construction, they were going to physically destroy the university. Now, why did you
negotiate many times?
Negotiate? What is to negotiate? What is? Don't you wait a minute on that issue? Don't you simply explain to these students that the university has a piece of property that it bought for future construction of the campus, and it was now going ahead with the plan?
The people of
what do you mean negotiate?
Governor Reagan, the time has passed when the university can just ride roughshod over the desires of the majority of its student body.
Well,
the university is a public institution.
That's
it's
right.
An important institution,
but the university,
for all of its own community, and for the community of Berkeley that live around it.
All of it began the first time some of you who know better and are old enough to know better let young people think that they had the right to choose the laws they would obey as long as they were doing it in the name of social protest.
Marcuse took to the media to make a justification for the student violence.
The violence is certainly not with the students. The violence is on the part of those against whom the students protest.
Nevertheless, isn't this a disruptive activity which harms the university?
If this disruptive activity contributes at least a little in stopping the insanity, I think it is more than justified.
By the summer of 1969, the new proletariat that Herbert Marcuse highlighted in One Dimensional Man just 4 years earlier had finally matured. They came together in July 1969 for a National Revolutionary Conference in Oakland, California, and the group revealed to the world their new alliance that was ready to come out from the shadows.
We're going to be on the streets and in every institution in this country from now on.
What would you put?
We're going to replace capitalism with socialism.
Black Panthers, Students for a Democratic Society, and the Communist Party USA each took the stage and boldly spoke of the violent revolution they were about to bring to the campuses and the streets of the United States. and they all sounded like Herbert Marcuse disciples.
We're going to fight some capitalism with some basic socialistic programs. We'll fight imperialism with proletarian internationalism.
We need socialism in practice. We need an understanding of Marxist-Leninist principles so that we may put our knowledge into revolutionary practice.
The struggle that is going to ultimately defeat United States imperialism is going to be an international struggle. It's going to be an armed struggle. It's going to be a struggle that's going to have to take place in the third world against U.S. imperialism and in the mother country against U.S. imperialism. We must be clear on how the final struggle will be waged, and we must be a part of that struggle. Students must be opening up the campuses to the working class, must be going into the working class communities, becoming part of the proletariat, and must be getting ready for armed struggle.
By the summer of 1969, the Frankfurt School Marxists had a plan.
Our program is going to be to come back on the campuses this fall and hit them harder than they've ever been hit before.
And boy, would they ever. The 1969-1970 academic school year produced the bloodiest on-campus conflicts in perhaps the history of American higher education. When the socialist revolutionaries emerged from the conflicts, they had a plan, and they would follow in the footsteps of Angela Davis to bring their brand of woke Marxism into the mainstream.
Coming up on Red Pilled America.
One of the largest to gather at UC Berkeley this year. The speaker, new left philosopher Herbert Marcuse, and his student, avowed communist Angela Davis.
Now, I think that the real reason that they're firing me is not only because of my membership in the Communist Party, but because I have tried to involve myself as much as I could in the black liberation struggle in this country.
The guard, under the pressure of a rock-throwing attack, panicked and fired its weapons indiscriminately, killing four people.
Turned out that two of the guns used in the courtroom were bought by Angela Davis. She was the teacher fired from the University of California at Los Angeles.
I think that the actions of the FBI in apprehending Angela Davis are rather remarkable. Story again, the long history of remarkable stories of apprehensions by the FBI.
If there's anyone capable of breaking the insanity which is daily reproduced, it is you, and it is only you, black, white, and brown.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Informed Ventures. Thanks for listening.